The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Evolution is the most majestic problem-solving force on the planet, but it also creates problems. Take the Suriname toad. After an undersea mating ritual that involves copious somersaults, the fertilized eggs are deposited on the female's back. The mama frog's skin grows around them, protecting her progeny from predators until they emerge en masse in a way that Wired science writer Matt Simon describes as a not-okay thing for humans to witness. Humans can witness a parade of eccentric life forms that have not perished, but adapted in remarkable and bizarre ways in Matt's new book, The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. You could call it The Survival of the Weirdest. And Matt Simon joins us now with more. Matt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
And thank you for having me.
Well, in the book, you write that evolution creates many problems, but also finds many solutions. There's this constant push, pull, churning and churning onward. And out of this comes absurd creatures?
Yes, very, very many of them. And there are so many problems in this world that I think you and I probably take for granted as humans that have largely removed ourselves from the food chain. A lot of these critters are battling not only predators, but parasites that are trying to inject them with their eggs, which is an unfortunate way to go through life. But when you get these solutions to certain problems, other creatures actually fight back with their own evolution. So you get kind of this push and pull of problem and solution and problem and solution. You get some very, very unique adaptations in the animal kingdom.
So throughout, they're just pursuing life. And you say that you know the meaning of life.
I do.
We finally arrived?
I'd hate to spoil this for everybody, but I figured it out on my own. No big deal. And I started the book out this way. The meaning of life is to get laid. It is to pass down your genes at any cost. And I open the book with a particular creature that does this in a unique way. Its name is Antechinus, and it's a marsupial from Australia, of course. What it does is it has a 2-week breeding season, which happens to be pretty short. So what the males have to do is mate with as many females as they possibly can in that 2 weeks. What happens is they don't really sleep, they don't eat. So eventually their bodies start reacting badly to that. They will lose their fur. They will bleed internally, which is unfortunate. And some of them will actually go blind toward the end, but still they're running around trying to find that last female. At the end of the breeding season, every single male will have perished from having too much sex. It sounds like not a solution at face value. It sounds like a problem in and of itself. But again, this is the meaning of life, passing down your genes at any cost. It doesn't matter if he survives that breeding season, because ideally his genes will pass on to the next generation if he has done his job properly.
Maybe we should revise that thing of calling a particularly randy male a dog or a pig and an antechinus.
Exactly.
Should become the new word. But where's the female in all of this?
So you would think that she's losing out pretty badly here. That sounds unfortunate. But at the end of the breeding season, again, all of the males are dead. That leaves her with a forest with tons and tons of insects. And that's important for a marsupial in particular because her young are born very underdeveloped. She has to produce a lot of milk and very nutritious milk to be able to feed them. And indeed, what seems to have happened over evolutionary time is females have actually shortened the breeding season to time with this abundance of insects in the spring. That left the males with only 2 weeks to do their business. At the end of 2 weeks, they're dead. The females have all these insects and they're better able to raise those young in the absence of any males.
This is the Darwinian principle of transmutation, right? You have as many progeny as possible, and some of them will have a chance of making it.
Exactly. Yeah, Darwin used the word transmutation. He actually shied away from the word evolution because it implied some progress. Evolution is not about progress. It's about creatures that are best fitted to their environment. We are humans. We have these great big brains, but that doesn't make us any better adapted than something like Antechinus that is going about life its own way.
Okay, so I want to get to the creatures involved in your title here, the wasp that brainwashed the caterpillar. And I'm seeing it as Glyptopantales wasp.
That's right.
So what is their advantage here? What is their push or pull?
Yeah, so insects aren't exactly known for their mothering instincts. It's more about laying the eggs and leaving and letting the young raise themselves, really. There are a couple of exceptions to that, but for the most part, insects do that. The Glyptopantales wasp goes about things rather more brutally. It adopts a babysitter for its young in the sense that it will find a caterpillar and inject it with as many as 80 eggs. Those eggs hatch inside the caterpillar and devour its insides, but are careful to avoid the vital organs to keep their host alive. After a little while, they will have developed into these nice little maggots that will then erupt en masse out of the caterpillar all at once. So you will have 80 of these things coming out of this poor caterpillar at one time. Amazingly, what is happening is these larvae, as they're developing, they're shedding their skin to grow a little bit bigger, and they actually time their last shedding with their egress, they call it, from the caterpillar. That actually plugs up the wound in the caterpillar's flesh. That keeps the caterpillar alive. And what happens next is something straight out of science fiction. It seems that two or three of the larvae will stay behind in the caterpillar and release some sort of chemical that starts controlling its brain. The brothers and sisters that have come out of the caterpillar will spin their cocoons, and the caterpillar will actually stick around and spin its own silk over those cocoons, which is odd because you would think it would have some sort of hard feelings toward these creatures that just erupted from its body. But it will not feed, it won't move, it'll sit right on top of those eggs and protect them at any cost. It will fling its head around violently to bash away any other parasites that might want to intrude, which is, again, very strange for something that was just assaulted by these little parasites. But it's a kind of an emerging field, and it's very widespread, this idea of parasitic manipulation of behavior. You get this across the animal kingdom in a bunch of different lineages, but it makes perfect sense because the wasp mother needs some way to protect her kids. And to do that, she enlists this hapless caterpillar that, unfortunately, after it has spun that silk over the eggs and protected them for a little while, once those eggs hatch into little baby wasps, they will fly away, and the caterpillar will unceremoniously starve to death.
Okay, so I'm thinking one for wasps, zero for the caterpillar there. But you write that a species may gain an edge, but any sort of edge gets answered. Okay, so what's the edge here for the caterpillar? I mean, why are they still alive if this happens to them?
This is not so much one of those examples. The caterpillar loses out pretty badly here. It hasn't evolved any sort of defense against this, but you might expect that this could eventually maybe come up at some point where the caterpillar, this one particular caterpillar, was born with some sort of resistance to this chemical release of the larvae, right? But that hasn't happened. You get this kind of push and pull between parasites and hosts in the animal kingdom, but unfortunately, in this case, the caterpillar kind of loses out pretty badly, inevitably.
We're speaking with Matt Simon. He's a science writer who writes the Absurd Creature of the Week column for the Wired magazine. He's author of The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. It is a very funny, illustrated book with snappy descriptions of some of these absolutely absurd creatures. For a creature to adapt, they are gaining an edge, but that can get quickly canceled out by the edge of another creature. What is an example of that?
Yeah, so this comes across also in parasites. Interestingly, when you get this behavioral manipulation in a little terrestrial isopod that we know as the pill bug, or roly-poly in some regions of the United States, it is invaded by a worm. And when that worm gets in there and starts developing, it actually controls the isopod's brain and kind of moves it out into the sunlight. That might make it more visible to birds where this worm must complete its life cycle. But you get this behavior also in other animals that are driven out into the open by parasites. And that could be descended from this strategy that a lot of parasites have to kind of bake off these parasites. The host will move out into the open, into the sun, and that raises their body temperature. They can handle that, but the parasites within cannot. And a lot of times you'll get a host that can overcome the worms inside of its body just based on temperature alone. So it's called behavioral fever. We have our own fever that's kind of automatic. It kicks in when we get sick. But some insects are actually able to control their body temperature like that to mount some sort of countermeasure against the parasites within.
In many of these cases, it's just not a good end. I mean, many of the creatures we meet in your book have a pretty rough road. Giving pay to this Darwinian principle that nature is red in tooth and claw, you know, indifferent to death and to suffering.
Yes. Yes, yes, there's so much of that. We have a whole section in the book about not getting eaten. That's a big problem for a lot of creatures out there. Again, we have removed ourselves from the food chain. We don't have to worry about that. One particularly interesting solution comes from this creature called the crested rat, which lives in Africa. It has its own predators, of course. It's a little rat and largely helpless as a mammal without any armor or things like that. What it does is it finds a very specific kind of tree with extremely toxic roots. It will chew up those roots and slather it along its side on these special hairs that soak up those toxins. And those hairs are actually colored black and white to kind of grab the attention of predators. So when this thing is under threat, it will actually flash that flank. The predator sees those colors, and ideally what the crested rat is doing is actually inviting this predator to bite on this very specific spot on its body. The predator gets a mouthful of these toxins and then perishes pretty quickly. It's remarkable mostly because how did the crested rat figure out how to do this in the first place? And how does the crested rat not itself perish when all it takes is to get a mouthful of this toxin to die very quickly?
It is so ingenious how these things develop or how they figure out how to hide or to live in weird places like the pearlfish. Tell us about the pearlfish there on the barren sea floor.
Oh, the pearlfish. Yeah, that's a tough one. So on the barren sea floor, you don't have the protection of a reef if you're a fish that you can kind of climb into and hide from your predators. What is available on the barren sea floor is the sea cucumber. The pearlfish is a sort of eel-like fish. It's long and thin, and when it finds a sea cucumber, it sniffs around and it finds its bum. The pearlfish then squirms up said bum and lodges itself in the respiratory tract of the sea cucumber. One of my favorite calculations in all of science that I've come across is a scientist actually went out and calculated how often the pearlfish will go in head first versus tail first. And it turns out that if you're an adult pearlfish, you're a little bit bigger around the head, you go in tail first because you look a lot like an eel. It's thin in that region. But juveniles will actually go in 80% of the time head first because they're much smaller. And the scientist found this calculation and put it in a paper and actually published it, which is lovely when you think about the editor who went through and okayed that.
Or the person who researched it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the guy was sitting there on the seafloor watching this with a piece of paper and ticking how many times the pearlfish goes in head first versus tail first, which is quite the job, really. But when the pearlfish gets in there, it's not exactly behaving itself. It will eat the internal organs of the sea cucumber, including the gonads. So the sea cucumber itself cannot reproduce any longer, which is an extra indignity considering when you get two pearlfish in a sea cucumber, they will mate inside and release their young into the environment. But really, this all comes from a lack of shelter on the seafloor. The sea cucumber has this amazing defense that the pearlfish is exploiting in the sense that it can contract its body and fire its intestines out of its bum, which doesn't sound like a defense at face value, but it does work. It does tend to scare away predators who are not expecting that sort of thing. But oddly enough, the pearlfish doesn't seem to elicit this response when it itself works its way up the sea cucumber. And that might be because of the regenerative powers of the sea cucumber. It can actually regenerate whole organs, like its intestines or gonads. So the sea cucumber might be making a calculation here where they're thinking, okay, I can let this pearlfish in. It's going to be unpleasant. But ideally, they're just going to eat the gonads and leave. I could fire my intestines out. That will take a whole lot longer to actually regenerate, leaving me a little bit weak. So you get these interesting calculations in the animal kingdom.
But we're also reminded that conflict is everywhere. You know, this is part of the world of evolution, that even though we as a species are far less violent than we were 1,000 or even 100 years ago, is there any level of comfort for you, you know, as a human being, as a writer, for us knowing that adaptation can be ingenious and it's possible?
Part of the reason why Darwin's ideas back in the 19th century were so society-shaking was it because it introduced this concept of a nature that is not in harmony. This isn't about creatures all getting along on Noah's Ark. This is about creatures doing very bad things to each other, all in the pursuit of survival and passing down their genes. I don't find that concerning like a lot of people do. It sounds nihilistic, but it is a very, very beautiful, intricate, and enchanting process, evolution by natural selection. As an organism, you produce more offspring than can possibly survive. That's by design because they're not all going to survive. But you get the ones that are surviving are the ones that are best adapted to their environment. That's what drives evolution. You get these mutations and variation that better suit your offspring for survival. It's a game of chance. And when you think about what the chance of evolution has provided in the animal kingdom, this 3.5 billion year history of life on Earth that produced mammals and insects and things like Antechinus doing weird things to each other, I think it's absolutely majestic. It's really something to be in awe of. And I really hope I did that justice in the book to kind of tease out these particularly interesting concepts in nature that often involve injecting eggs into caterpillars and things like that. But I'm consistently humbled by the fact that evolution has produced the most amazing wonders on the face of planet Earth.
Matt Simon, a science writer at Wired Magazine, thank you very much for speaking with us.
And thank you for having me.
You can find much more on Matt's book, The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. There's a link at wordofmathradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The docket for the Trump administration's first 100 days is loaded with a few stridently partisan issues, including the Affordable Care Act, climate change, and trade policy. But there are still a few issues with bipartisan support that legislators are united in challenging as soon as possible, including the regulatory status of catfish. Yes, catfish. It turns out that the bottom-feeding fish has political connections in high places. Kara Gimo is a staff writer for Atlas Obscura, who looked into this strange political battle over how catfish should be regulated. She's joining us now via Skype. Kara, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Hi, great to be here.
So we in New England may not be so familiar with catfish, but it's pretty important in the American diet and economy. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally don't eat a lot of catfish here up north either, but if you go down south, it's a pretty common sight. It has always been an important part of the American diet. It was a big fish for both Native Americans and European settlers. You can stew it, you can fry it. And it was actually the first fish to be farmed on a large scale in America. Aquaculture catfish farms began in the 1960s and have sort of grown since then, spreading across a lot of the southern states.
So it's a pretty important economic part of Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Big source of income, and in the free trade market, that means competitors. So who's now angling for a piece of the U.S. catfish pie?
Yeah, there's another species of catfish called Pangasius, also called Asian catfish. And it's mostly from Vietnam, although other Asian countries produce it as well. And after the U.S.-Vietnam trade embargo got lifted, which was a couple decades back, Pangasius became a big competitor to American catfish, and American catfish producers got a little bit worried about that.
So this is the basis of this catfish dispute. What is at the center of this argument?
There's a couple of things. It's funny because if you talk to people on either side of the issue, as with everything, they have slightly different stories. So the catfish producers will say that this is a health and safety issue, that catfish from Vietnam is not produced in facilities that are necessarily as clean as American facilities, that it comes over and it sometimes contains bacteria or is otherwise unfit to pass American food safety standards. And so they say that we have to have tighter regulations on catfish because otherwise the catfish supply will not be safe.
This doesn't often happen, that the catfish industry asks for more regulation.
Yeah, absolutely not. I think that's pretty rare. Usually you have businesses wanting to be regulated as little as possible.
So did this push for more regulation pass in Congress?
It did. It passed. The 2008 version of the Farm Bill basically moved the duty of inspecting catfish from one U.S. agency to another. It got moved from the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, to the USDA, which is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this like just sounds like a whole bunch of alphabet soup. But it's actually pretty strange because the USDA, its normal duties include inspecting meat, poultry, and eggs. That goes back to the days of Upton Sinclair when everybody was so horrified at what was going on in different meat packing facilities that they decided that meat should have more regulation than your average kind of box of cereal or, you know, tub of Jell-O. And meanwhile, the FDA does everything else. It inspects everything else, and it does that on more of a random basis rather than constantly checking every single thing that goes through a factory.
Except for catfish.
Except for catfish, yeah. So I'm not sure that these standards have actually changed yet. But the idea is that so the bill has already passed, but if it doesn't get repealed and if everything goes according to plan, catfish will be inspected by the USDA along with meat and poultry and eggs. And every single other fish will be inspected by the FDA.
We'll get to the politics in just a minute, but catfish then is in this kind of limbo state. I'm trying to figure out how they do it mechanically. You know, how does the USDA actually manage inspecting catfish?
Right. So that's kind of where the controversy comes in. People who are anti this new provision that don't think that catfish should be inspected by the USDA say that this move is a recipe for duplication. Basically, every single fish provider in the U.S. will have to have not only an FDA inspector that comes in, does its checks, and then heads out, but also a USDA inspector who is on hand all the time, but only for catfish. And so the way that one of my sources put it to me was, like, picture you're in a seafood facility, and the tuna comes down the line, and then the cod comes down the line, and then the crab or whatever else comes down the line, and it's all inspected as normal, and then kind of have to shut everything down, recheck everything, and then put the catfish down the line for the new inspector who has sort of just arrived to do this one thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's definitely unusual.
So I want to get it straight. The Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen from here in New Hampshire and Republican Senator John McCain are against or looking to eliminate this special status of catfish regulation?
Yes, they want to sort of knock out this special catfish status and put it back in with the rest of the seafood because they think it's sort of a waste of time and money.
Okay, and who is in opposition to that?
It seems like it's mostly this one big lobbying group called Catfish Farmers of America. And they used to have the support of food safety groups as well, although food safety groups have begun sort of backtracking their support. And this one senator, Tad Cochran from Mississippi, tends to be the person, he has a lot of power, and he tends to be the person who sort of at the last minute says, okay, if I'm going to pass this bill, we need to keep the special catfish status in there. And then it continues moving forward.
Well, I guess with still some bipartisan support, maybe catfish could be the issue that unites America.
Right. I mean, one can only hope that there will be something.
Kara Jaimo, she's a staff writer at Atlas Obscura. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link to read Kara's article on why the U.S. government treats catfish unlike any other fish. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. When it comes to identity politics and issues where prejudice, ignorance, and misinformation cloud or prevent discussion, what is the best way to reach across the divide and find common ground? Twitter? Unlikely. How about a face-to-face discussion? In 2014, a study showing that a 20-minute conversation with a gay or lesbian canvasser could reduce homophobia and get opponents of gay marriage to switch sides was published to a lot of fanfare. Proof that human interaction and dialogue could influence public opinion. Maybe you heard about it on This American Life.
And here's just how real and free-floating this conversation is. At one point, the voter feels comfortable enough to ask him,
At what point did you realize you were gay? I mean, how does a child realize they're gay?
I can think back to third grade, and I had a crush on a boy in the class. Some people think that being gay is a choice. I was talking with a voter, and he was telling me he thought it was a choice, and I said my choice was to accept being gay, and because I tried to be straight, and that just wasn't working.
Well, yeah, if it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work.
And then at that point, the canvasser, Richard, very skillfully brings them back to the topic at hand.
So you have, your vote has a lot of influence on how my life goes. I'm with somebody now.
That's a lot to think about, too, because, you know, after meeting you, you're a hell of a nice guy.
The study was later retracted after the author admitted to fabricating some of the results. It was kind of a big scandal. Now a new study by the same researchers that debunked the first one may have succeeded in validating those early results, this time with the trans community. Josh Kalla is a PhD student from UC Berkeley and co-author of this new study called Durably Reducing Transphobia, a field experiment on door-to-door canvassing. Josh, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Virginia.
And the study tracks the work of David Fleischer, project director at the Leadership Lab, which organized the door-to-door canvassing featured on both studies. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
So, David, walk me through one of these interactions. You've just knocked on someone's door. Is there a script or training that you give to volunteers?
Yeah, there's extensive training because the single most important thing we do at the door, it's not what we tell the voter nearly so much as our building a rapport with them so that we can listen to what they have to say to us. And the conversation is most successful when we have voters be honest with us about their own prejudice.
So if you've just knocked on my door, what's the first thing you say?
Hi, Virginia. I'm Dave. I'm with the Leadership Lab, and we're talking to every registered voter in your neighborhood about an important issue. It's whether we're going to include transgender people in our non-discrimination laws. If you were going to make a decision about this, would you want to include transgender people in the non-discrimination laws or not include them in them?
Josh, you studied the results of those interactions, and what did you find? How effective is this method of interaction or intervention?
Yeah, we found that these types of door-to-door conversations were pretty incredibly effective at reducing transphobia, both in the short term and over a 3-month period. We found that these interactions tended to reduce transphobia on the order of magnitude kind of comparable to how much homophobia decreased from 1998 to 2012.
Some of these canvassers are actually transgender, some were not. Was that a factor in reducing or measuring transphobia among those participants?
Yeah, I think one of the most important parts of this study was that we found that both transgender and non-transgender canvassers were similarly effective at reducing transphobia. There was really no difference between whether or not you were part of the trans community, or you were just an ally going out to help.
David, you actually did some of this canvassing. We started the conversation. Ever find yourself getting into a debate or an argument with somebody who answered the door?
No, because our approach isn't to argue. We're really genuinely curious about what the voter has to say. And when we come to the conversation in a non-judgmental way and with some humility, what's impressive to me is that so many people really want to talk with us, even people who start out in opposition, in fact, are conflicted. And as we talk it through and they get to reflect on their real lived experience, either with transgender people or with their experience when they've been judged unfairly for who they are, they realize that they actually want to be less prejudiced against transgender people.
Have you ever heard from anyone who answered the door that they actually never met or spoken to somebody who is from the trans community?
Overwhelmingly, that's the case. More than 90% of the people we talk with have never met a transgender person, and a significant number have never really had a conversation with an LGBT person. Remember, Virginia, we're going to neighborhoods where we know most people are against us. So we could go to other neighborhoods where people are already on our side, and perhaps it'd be more common for people to know transgender people there.
So you're targeting conservative voting districts or zip codes?
That's exactly right.
That's David Fleischer. He is the project director of the Leadership Lab. I'm speaking with him and Josh Kalla. He's co-author of a study that found that a 10-minute conversation can have measurable effects in reducing transphobia. And those conversations come courtesy of David's group. So in a similar study, this was published in 2014, that made big waves, and an episode of This American Life that a lot of our listeners may have heard, but then later retracted. Now, this was after you and your co-author, another grad student, discovered that some of the data had been fabricated. How did that affect your process moving forward? Why did you decide to do it again?
Well, we had discovered the fabrication while planning this study on reducing transphobia. We had to dig into the original data in order to do something really banal, which was just figure out how big this experiment had to be, how many conversations Dave and his volunteers needed to have. And then the process of planning this experiment is when we discovered those irregularities. And the experiment was already set, and Dave and his team were committed to having these conversations and doing this experiment regardless of what we found.
Was there some sense that this could work differently?
Yeah, I think when we discovered the irregularities in the original study, that did not disprove the effectiveness of the conversations. It just meant we had no experimental evidence on whether or not the conversations were effective. But that lack of evidence doesn't mean negative evidence. Instead, what we had were the experiences of Dave and his team, and my co-author and I both also went canvassing with Dave and his team. So we really had these firsthand experiences that made it seem like there was something definitely happening at the doors and something worthwhile measuring.
David, given that for most people, going door to door is not an option to introduce themselves to somebody who thinks differently, how do you think that this lesson or these findings about empathy extend into other forms of communication? So social media, for example, or a family gathering?
Well, what I would suspect is that there's not a way to replicate this on social media, because you need to speak with people who disagree with you, and you need them to trust you. You need them to be honest. I don't know how you would be able to create that kind of an environment other than face-to-face. And then doing it with a family member at Thanksgiving is, I think, a possibility. And it would be really important that if somebody wanted to undertake that, there was some way in which they were doing this as part of a team, both so they could get training, and even though the conversation itself would be one-on-one, these are kind of scary conversations, and the stakes are even higher if you're talking to a family member than if you're talking with a stranger. So people would need to have a way to debrief with somebody afterwards, so they'd have support if they had a conversation that didn't change somebody's mind.
We're looking at a split of a public opinion anyway in polling in the United States, about 40% approval rating for incoming President Donald Trump, about 55% of people vehemently opposed. But without that training, without a team around you, how do you advise people to, you know, walk across that parking lot to someone with a different bumper sticker or something like that and have a dialogue? Is that a good idea?
Well, sure, it's a good idea. The biggest things to keep in mind are that you can get some training. There's going to be some training material online that we've just been lucky enough to create after I gave a TEDx talk that will go up in the next week or two. And the truth is, if you approach somebody with an attitude of real curiosity, you're going to get further than you might expect. And then finally, keep in mind that most people who polls show are strongly committed to one position or another, often that's a bit of an illusion. People are more complicated than that and are more conflicted than that. And once they know they can trust you to treat them decently and not judge, the possibility of having a good conversation is there. I grew up in Chillicothe, Ohio, a small town, and even when I was a boy, it was normal for neighbors to talk with each other about political disagreements. It's normal, actually, for one human being to talk with another human being and be affected by them.
Josh, how about for you? What's the next step after doing a study like this, finding these results, publishing them? Where do you go to now?
These results are incredibly promising. As Dave was saying, this is not new, having these types of face-to-face conversations. What is new is we just have evidence that these face-to-face conversations work. And I think the real next questions are, why do they work? Can we figure out some kind of broader principles from psychology and human interactions that can teach us something deep about how people talk and how people are persuaded? And then I think the next question is also, on what other issues can you effectively persuade someone? How can these types of conversations be applied more directly to issues of politics or racism or Islamophobia or whatever it may be?
Josh Kalla, co-author along with David Brookman of Durably Reducing Transphobia, a field experiment on door-to-door canvassing. Josh, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
And David Fleischer is project director at the Leadership Lab, which did the canvassing. David, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a real pleasure, Virginia. Thank you.
You can read more about the study and an article about David's work. It's from the New York Times. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Stumped on a state capitol? Can't remember the name of that guy, you know, from that movie? Use the Googles. Google is by far the world's most popular search engine / curator of information, but that doesn't mean its results are true. Try Googling, did the Holocaust happen, or is the Holocaust real, and prepare for a barrage of fake news stories from Holocaust deniers and white supremacist websites. Melanie Ehrenkranz is a tech reporter for the news site Mike.com. She looked into how Google's algorithm is being used as a tool to promote Nazi propaganda. Melanie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what happens when you Googled, is the Holocaust real?
Sure. So, you know, and I did this in an incognito mode. So this is not influenced by my browsing history or my habits. So when I Googled, is the Holocaust real or did the Holocaust happen? The leading search result for both of those were neo-Nazi content claiming that the Holocaust, in fact, did not happen, which is, you know, a well-documented and not up for debate discussion.
So I actually did this myself, and the top two stories were actually about this story, that Google's search results were indeed influenced by neo-Nazi sites or white supremacist sites. The third one was from Stormfront, which is a white pride site. So there have been maybe some adjustments that Google's made. What has Google officially said about the appearance of those sites?
That's great to hear that when you searched for the same thing, you were given accurate news sites. I've kind of been, Mike has been investigating these searches to see how the algorithm has been updated to address the issue. I searched for these a few weeks ago, and that's when the Stormfront article and another Holocaust denial site came up. About a week after that, Google did come out with a statement saying that they had adjusted their algorithm to surface to the top more credible, high-quality sources. A few other news outlets found that top result was no longer the hateful content. It had kind of been pushed down, not removed, but pushed down on the page. Yesterday we checked in incognito mode for both of those search results and found that the Stormfront article and another claiming that the Holocaust didn't happen had been pushed back to the top.
Okay. So this is a problem. Why is this a problem with Google's algorithm, by the way?
Sure. I mean, I can't say the specifics of why this might be happening, but Google has said that they adjust their algorithm routinely to make sure that credible, relevant sources get surfaced to the top. And that's why this was so baffling to me, because, arguably an article saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, when someone asked in the search bar if the Holocaust happened, being the top result, to me is not credible or relevant. It would be nice to have a bit more transparency as to why these neo-Nazi websites are being pushed up to the top.
Okay, so relevance meaning the more people search on them, or maybe some kind of bot feeds and says, this is the best site, so it goes to the top of Google's search results. But can Google do anything so that those kind of sites do not appear as top responses to queries?
Google did say, that while there might be hateful sites online or in the search results, that they don't endorse those points of view. However, there are only limited cases in which they would actually remove a link from their search result page altogether. And they didn't say that they would remove those links. Why was not explained, but they do have the power to remove links if it meets certain guidelines. That is something they can do, something that they evidently have not done.
Well, and this is also at a time when hate crimes are on the rise, when fake news is news in itself. So what is Google's policy on fake news?
That's a great question. They haven't explicitly said what their guideline is for fake news. They just said that there are limited cases. They listed illegal content, malware, or violations to their guidelines as examples in which they would remove content. As for fake news, that's also a very broad and vague term. It's come to mean a lot of things to different people. But, it is important for Google to address that they have the power to spread misinformation.
We took a look at Google's Webmaster Guidelines page, and one of the principles is don't deceive your users. Now, I know that leaves a lot of gray area. What are some of the other pretty well-established facts that turn up differently and when you do a Google search?
So, you can Google search, is climate change real? And you'll get the featured snippets, which are those boxes that you'll see when, you ask certain questions. And in this instance, it says climate change. There's a climate change deniers article that pops up that says the debate is over about whether or not climate change is real. It, cites irrefutable evidence. So there are examples in which something that is true and well-documented can reflect that when you Google search something. That is not happening when it comes to this particular search, whether the Holocaust happened. Google also used to have an in the news section, which it ended up killing. It was also found that, the algorithms were highlighting more fake news with this feature, and so they ended up killing a feature. So Google has shown that they are aware of their influence, they are aware of their flaws, and they have acted on it in the past. It just seems to be something that needs to be maybe more swiftly addressed, and there needs to be more transparency around how these algorithms are determining the top featured.
The case is often made that algorithms are free of bias because they are just based on numbers. Do you see bias in the algorithms that Google is using?
I mean, yes, I think that's evident in this specific instance. And it's been proven that algorithms, they're not free from bias because, you know, humans create them and humans also influence them based on their input. So, you know, we've seen that in examples where you Google searched for black teenagers, it was pulling up photos of mugshots. Or, for example, Microsoft had K, which was its bot, and it kind of turned into a white supremacist quickly based on the questions and feedback it was getting from online users. So I think in these instances, along with many others, it's proven that algorithms are not free from human bias. You know, just because it's not in nature a human, humans are using them and creating them.
Melanie Ehrenkranz, a tech reporter for the news site Mike.com, thank you for speaking with us. You can read Melanie's article, Google's Acceptance of Nazi Search Results is Normalizing Hate. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time listening today. Music in this episode came to us from Valella Valella, Pottington Bear, Tyler Gibbons, and Ketza. Lots more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play for the Word of Mouth podcast. It is one easy click to subscribe, and then you will never miss a thing being shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.